The following podcast is from Tabernacle Baptist Church in Cartersville, Georgia. Thanks for listening.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, again. So we're going to talk on the subject of dinosaurs tonight. And I mentioned to you this morning that we have so much information today that, you know, we never had 20, even 30 years ago. And dinosaurs are really kind of the poster child for evolution, because your young ones, whenever they hear the word dinosaurs, whenever they're presented on TV and books, they're always associated with the concept of millions of years and evolution. But in fact, with modern creationist research in particular, dinosaurs are actually one of the most exciting evidences we have today for biblical creation, and as a direct refutation to the evolutionary concept that they lived and died millions of years ago. So let me just set that up for you, because it's going to become important as we go along. The evolutionary paradigm says about 300 million years ago, dinosaurs first evolved, and around about 66 million years ago, they died out, or actually they evolved into birds. They grew feathers and flew, etc. So that's the general big picture concept that you would see in books today. And again, a reminder, on our website, we've got a whole section on dinosaurs. If you look at the very, very bottom where the sitemap is, there's topics, and you can go from everything from anthropology, aliens, genetics, geology, zoology, everything in between. Remember, there's over 15,000 articles on that website. So listen, I could stand up here and talk for millions of years, and I still wouldn't get through all the questions you have on your mind. But that's what that resource is there for. You know, put up the right talk here for myself. Let's do another snap poll. You must think I like polls to trick you. Have a look here on the screen. We've got a parrot, a T-Rex, a dolphin, and a fish. Notice the question: which one of these has been on Earth the longest? I'll give you time to think about it. All right, who thinks A, the parrot? Hands up, come on, be brave, anybody? All right, what about the T-Rex? All right, okay, what about C, the fish? All right, and D, the dolphin? Most of you didn't answer, which means I should probably have a fifth question. Who's too chicken to say, anybody? Most of you, all right. Well, again, the point this morning was to look at things biblically, okay? So here's the Big Bang way of looking, creation account of looking at things. Notice here, on day five, we have the birds and the sea creatures. It actually says birds, but actually the Bible says the word, Hebrew word, oph, O-P-H, we might transliterate that, which literally means creatures that move in the air. So birds, think of other creatures that move in the air. Bats, they're reptiles. Okay, what about the big flying reptiles like tyrannosaurs or pteranodons? And land animals and man were made on day six. So if I go back to this, okay, remember they say dinosaurs evolved into birds, evolutionists, but according to the Bible, birds preceded dinosaurs. T-Rex is a land animal, creatures that move along the ground. There are other ways we could look at this. In fact, when you look at that, plants were made on day three and the sun was not created until day four. Of course, there was light on day one. God himself made the light. And in the new heavens and earth, it says again, the Lamb will be the light. So I'm just answering one of those answers book questions, because people say, the sun wasn't created till day four. How could there be light? Okay. Of course, God made the light source on day one. But if these days were millions and billions of years each, how could you have plants surviving for millions of years on that case, before the sun on day four, for example? So again, the order is wrong. There's lots and lots of examples where the evolutionary order is out of sync. You see, they say there was a Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago, the Earth and the Sun about 4.5 billion years ago, and early life, well, they're still trying to figure that out, okay, how life generally began. And again, when we look at dinosaurs, it's about how we're going to look at the data. What lens are you going to look at them through? The biblical lens, or if you like, the humanistic secular worldview lens. By the way, here's the passage in Genesis 1:25. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then he created Adam and Eve and declared it all very good. Notice the biblical word there is kinds. Okay, I'll talk about this more in a bit. Boys and girls, the word species is a man-made modern word. The Bible always talks about biblical kinds or kinds of animals. Now I'm going to deal with a few urban legends about dinosaurs that kind of persuade and cloud our thinking. The one is that they're always these gigantic creatures, fearsome meat eaters. Why? Well, when we look at some of the large dinosaurs, like this guy, they've got these huge teeth, and we think, wow, wouldn't they be good for ripping each other apart, etc. Have a look here on T-Rex. A lot of people don't know they actually have little serrations on the edge. I mean, that's just like the steak knives Mum's got at home, right? Great for cutting open meat. So obviously they must have been meat eaters. Well, let's have a look at this creature. Now I'm not going to tell you what it is yet, but maybe I'll tell you a few things about it. So when you look at those long pointy fangs on the front, maybe I could reason, you know, with this long snout that they're great for grabbing hold of its prey. You know, once I get that pincer lock in there, they're not going anywhere, right? And these teeth on the side, they're actually so sharp that if I was to break one off, I could slice a piece of paper with it. I mean, they're brilliant for sawing off flesh and that type of stuff, right? So anybody want to have a guess? I'll take about three. Be brave. Anybody want to have a guess what you think that is the skull of? Anybody? Okay. Alligator. See, most people say some sort of carnivorous creature, a meat eater. Why? Well, because I deceived you. Not a nice thing to do. There's a valuable lesson here. That's the skull of a fruit bat. What does a fruit bat eat? Fruit. You see, boys and girls, notice this morning I said we have the same facts. But did you see how I presented that to you? All I've got is a skull with sharp teeth, but I said, oh, maybe those teeth are designed for tearing creatures apart. So I clouded, or if you like, I steered the way of our thinking about it. But in fact, it's a fruit bat. These guys used to flap around in my back garden eating my papayas back in Australia. They're actually a pest. So again, be careful about how the evidence is presented to you. Separate the facts from the storytelling. In fact, maybe T-Rex was designed for eating something like cantaloupes or vegetables like that. Does that sound ridiculous? Well, actually, we were all created to be vegetarian, not just human beings. The Bible says, and the animals also. But there's been a change, hasn't there? In fact, how many of you went to a Mexican restaurant and ate, you know, steak or something for lunch? Okay, but we were originally designed to be meat eaters. The fall changed, obviously, the environment somewhat, and also changed the nature of the world. I'm going to talk more about that, actually, in the next talk. But human beings and animals were originally designed to be vegetarian. Now you're going to hear stories like, well, what about these animals that have specialized diets and can only survive getting high protein food, etc.? It's actually not true. It's as simple as that. It's not true. Lots of stories in Creation magazine on our website of lions and tigers that have been reared, never touched a piece of meat in their life. Okay? It's a preference, and it can also be a learned behavior in the wild. I was horrified some years ago watching a nature documentary on TV, and there's this clearing in Africa where these little bonobo monkeys were, and suddenly these chimpanzees, right, large apes, which we typically think of as vegetarians, came running and running and running, and they scared these little monkeys up the trees, and wading up the trees were other chimpanzees who grabbed hold of them by the legs and smashed their skulls on the trees and ate their brains. Wow, chimps are not meat eaters. But see, this particular tribe, if you like, of chimps had learned that behavior. And they've suddenly found out they can eat meat and that brains of other monkeys are a delicacy. See, some of these things can be learned on, passed on in the animal kingdom. One of the biggest confusing areas comes from dinosaurs in the Bible, because you don't see the word dinosaur in the Bible. No, you don't. And that's because the word dinosaur is a modern word. It wasn't invented until 1841 by this scientist called Sir Richard Owen. He had the bones of a iguanodon and a megalosaur, and he said, wow, these look like the bones of some fearsome or terrible lizard. And the word dinosaur is actually a Greek term, literally meaning fearsome lizard. So think about some other modern words we have, like motor car. You don't see that in the Bible, do you? Right? When they discovered what they thought was these new creatures in the fossils, they invented a name for them. Okay? But if dinosaurs lived along with man, because they were created on day six, there must have been a different name for them earlier. And again, if we try to make dinosaurs millions of years old, we get the dinosaur, what did we know about dinosaurs? From the fossils. And as I said this morning, there's lots of death in the fossil record. Here's a rib cage from a sauropod dinosaur. A sauropod are those ones with the huge long necks and the long tails. And they're scanning a fossilized tumor, a cancerous tumor. And they say, wow, that looks like tumors that have just around, you know, we see today. And look, cancer's been around for millions of years. Would you have had cancer in the fossil record before Adam and Eve, again, with God calling it good? Now, one of the reasons, as I said earlier, we're fascinated with dinosaurs is because they are some of the largest creatures that ever lived, certainly the largest land animals that ever lived amongst some of the kinds of dinosaurs. But did you know some of them were actually as small as a chicken? In fact, when we look at the fossils, about 90% of the fossils we found would show that the average size of the dinosaur kinds is about the size of a small pony, something like that. But of course, some grew to be very, very big, didn't they? Can you just imagine, you've got to have your teeth in to say this one, Compsognathus. Okay, imagine if he was still around today, you'd have had KFD for lunch instead of KFC, right? But all dinosaurs, even the very, very large ones, they all came from eggs. And until recently, we thought about the largest eggs we found were only about the size of a football, but they've now found some longer eggs, a couple of feet long. They're quite elongated in their size. Now, whilst that might sound large for an egg, remember some of these dinosaurs grew to be 60 feet long. But the point here is they all originally started off very, very small. And of course, they grew. I mean, people, when they see fossils of dinosaurs, and I've seen this with Christians, we go through these kind of mental and theological gymnastics to explain them away. Or maybe Satan created their fossils in the rocks to deceive people or something like this. No, they're part of God's magnificent creation. If you strip away the millions of years and evolution that is associated with them, we can understand dinosaurs in the right biblical perspective. But look at the leg bone on that guy. I mean, you'd hear him coming before you saw him, wouldn't you? I mean, the ground would literally move. In fact, one of the famous sauropod dinosaurs they called Seismosaurus, which means earth-shaking lizard. That's how big he was. And when you compare the size, well, here's a 737-900, one of the most common planes flown today. But have a look. Dreadnought is here is nearly as big as a 737 if he was to stretch his neck out. That's pretty big. And they've actually now found larger ones than Dreadnoughtus, including this one called Amphicelius. Now, when you look at all of these are all sauropod dinosaurs, or most of them here, the long neck and the long tail. You see, they all look pretty similar, don't they? And I actually think what happens is, and you're going to see in a minute, is that when we find their fossils, and I've got to point this out, we very rarely ever find complete fossils. It almost never happens. There's fragments of bones, etc. Let me give you an example. So you look at Amphicelius here. Look at what they found. See right at the top? It's a piece of backbone. That's it. That's all they found. Now, don't get me wrong. Again, I'm not suggesting a conspiracy, but if they compare that to something like Seismosaurus or Argentinosaurus, they'd say, well, that piece of backbone is very similar, but it's much bigger. Therefore, he must have been a much bigger creature. Fair enough. But did you notice they gave it another species name? Whereas what I think we're doing here, we're looking at variation within an original created kind. Right? Dogs must have been a created kind. Cats must have been a created kind. Look at the variation you get within a created kind. Keeping in mind, all they ever do is they find fossils in the ground, and most of the pictures and the image you get from those are, in fact, storytelling. Fossils. I showed you this morning an ichthyosaur in the process of giving birth. Here's a fish in the process of eating his lunch. I mean, he's a really slow eater if it took millions of years, right? Again, we have millions and millions of fossils that show rapid burial, rapid deposition of sediments to cover them, etc. Even things like fossilized dinosaur skin. Yes, that's a skin impression. You can see the creases in the skin and the little bumps and the nodules on it. Again, how do you get a piece of skin unless it was almost plaster cast in the fossil record? Remember this morning how I showed you how fossils are formed? Well, in the Australian Dinosaur Museum, National Museum in Canberra, same story. Just to show you this morning was not an aberration. Here's the dinosaur, and he dies and he sinks to the ocean floor or the lake floor. And notice, have a look, he gets slowly covered with sediments. See, it's where the millions of years comes from. And then for some reason, you know, he gets uncovered, we find him, and then depending upon the depth often in the rock layers is when they will or how they attribute that long age to him. The deeper they find them, the older, etc. Again, in terms of detail, have a look at this. A fossilized fish. Look at the preservation, the fins, the eyes, the gills. Incredible. I mean, in the oceans, as I said to you this morning, you know, dead things don't last very, very long. It becomes food for everything else. And again, I said that fossils don't take millions of years. I had a soft felt hat. Here's what was a leather hat in the little island state of Tasmania off the south coast of Australia. This was buried in an old mine, and it was actually just submerged in water. But the water was heavily laden with minerals and calcium, and in less than 50 years, again, it turned into a piece of solid rock. Remember, you just need the right conditions. And when we see all these types of fossils, and the reason I'm showing you this is sometimes we see dinosaurs in the process of eating each other as well. And they've been fossilized in a fighting pose. It's evidence, again, that they were buried very, very quickly. Noah's flood. All over the world, every continent on this planet, we have lots and lots of fossils, right? So remember, evolution says all of this stuff would have been happening in different locations at different times, whereas a global flood is really the best way to explain it all. And in recent years, there's been an absolute revolution in this area. This, as I say, the most exciting time to be a Bible-believing creationist. Some years ago, they discovered unfossilized red blood cells in the leg bone of a T-Rex. So what you're looking at there is a tiny blood vessel, and those dots there, hemoglobin. So remember what I said at the beginning. The last dinosaur kind of lived 65, 66 million years ago, and we are finding red blood cells still in its organic state. Do you honestly think, I mean, you're not rocket scientists like, I can say like me, I'm not a rocket scientist. I mean, I'm not a rocket scientist, all right? Do you think red blood cells could survive that long? Even under very, very good conditions. The same scientist, in another expedition years later, they had this giant T-Rex leg bone. It was a remote location here in the American outback, and they couldn't drive in, and they could only get a helicopter in. And this giant leg bone, well, they said, we've got to get it in the helicopter, so they kind of chopped it in half, and they got a surprise, because as some of the outside matrix fell away, they found a ligament, flesh, more blood vessels, more red blood cells, and they said it was flexible and resilient when stretched and returned to its original shape. See, it doesn't really fit the millions of years paradigm, does it? It sounds like these creatures must have existed more recently. The scientist, Mary Schweitzer, she's an evolutionist, and she went through a very, very difficult time when she released this from her own evolutionary colleagues. And some days they say, you can't say those things because, you know, if the creationists get hold of it, what are they going to do? So in that sense, there is a little bit of censorship kind of going on because they don't want to make a big deal of it. And she came under incredible pressure. She said, when you think about it, the laws of chemistry and biology and everything else that we know say that it should be gone. It should be degraded quickly. What does she mean by that, biology and chemistry? Well, if you hit a deer on the road and it lies on the side of the road, it's not going to last very long, is it? I talked about the oceans, but nothing even lasts long out here in the terrestrial world. I mentioned I've been to South Africa a few times. Oops, let me go back one. And we were taken to Kruger Park, and we were doing one of those safaris, and the guy said, I just want to take you over to this water hole. And he said, 3 days ago, a lion had just made a kill of one of those water buffaloes. Now, have you ever seen those water buffaloes on TV in Africa? I mean, they're like the size of a mini car. Huge, gnarly beasts, very angry, cantankerous things. You know, some of them weigh around, 2,000 pounds. I mean, they're massive creatures. And they said the lions had just killed it. Look what's left after 3 days. The big cats come in, the little cats in, the dogs, you know, the vultures, and then the insects and the birds, and I mean, everybody has their go. And nothing lasts long. So how reasonable is it to think when you have all of these fossils all over the world perfectly preserved, and particularly stuff in its organic state, that it would still survive? And look at this one. This was a huge shock to the evolutionary community because they found unfossilized DNA in the bone cells of a T-Rex. Now, if you don't know, in the nucleus of our cells and every living creature is this chemical molecule called DNA, and it's basically a computer code that tells the cells to build, you know, a frog, a fish, human being, how tall you're going to be, how much melanin content you're going to have in your skin, and so on. And every time our cells reproduce, we get mutations, copying mistakes. And that's ultimately the reason we die. But we have these fantastic machines that try to repair the letter mistakes in the DNA. Now, they don't get all of them because we don't live in a perfect world anymore, and that's why entropy of our DNA continues. By the way, there's a bit of a chicken and egg problem here, because the code to build the machines that repair the DNA is actually on the DNA. Which came first? Chicken or egg problem, isn't it? They both had to be working perfectly the first time that they appeared. But DNA, is a very fragile molecule. And the reason I told you that story is when death occurs, there's no repairing of it. The machinery shuts down. It decays very, very quickly. And Dr. Jonathan Safady, one of our scientists, has shown that even if you could snap freeze DNA, it would continue to degrade. It would have a maximum age, if it remained permanently frozen, of about 200,000 years. But hang on, the last dinosaur died out 65 million years ago. Again, it's evidence that dinosaurs lived until very, very recently. This is the stuff you don't see in the secular science textbooks, boys and girls. As I said, the evidence is on our side. And as I said, the word dinosaur is a modern word, and that's why you won't see it in the Bible. We do see a couple of interesting creatures, including this one in Job 40:15. He's called Behemoth. And let's look at what God is saying to the man Job. Behold, Behemoth, which I made along with you, he eats grass like an ox. He's a vegetarian, point one. Strength in his loins, force in the muscles of his belly. Now, if it is a sauropod dinosaur, like we're picturing there, he has these huge hip bones, front and rear. Why? Because he's got to cradle huge muscles capable of moving a long neck and a long tail. Yeah, possibly it might be a reference to that. He hangs his tail like a cedar, sinews of his thighs are knit together, bones like tubes of bronze, like bars of iron. There's a real clue in there as to what creature that might be. And that's when it says he hangs his tail like a cedar. See, when God was speaking to Job, he would have been referencing things that he knew and understood. And presumably Job lived somewhere in the Middle East, so I think God would have been referring him to what we call the cedars of Lebanon. Now, you know, my lovely NIV study Bible that I've got, when I read the study notes in the bottom on this passage, it tells me he might be referring to a hippo or an elephant. Okay? So let's do the exercise. Here's this cedar tree-like tail. By the way, there's the cedar trees of Lebanon. The Egyptians used to send expeditions to the Levant here because they didn't have wood of their own, because these were such prized trees. Remember, Solomon built the temple from the cedars of Lebanon. So we have this tree-like tail, and there's the hippo. Doesn't quite fit, does it? Took that picture when I was in Africa as well. Here's the three wise elephants. Do they look like they have tails like a hippo? Like a cedar tree? No, of course they don't. And see, the only thing I can think of that has a tree-like tail of any terrestrial animal that we know of are the great sauropod dinosaurs. And there's an elephant down there for scale. That's a bull elephant, by the way, a large male by comparison. I mean, they're pretty impressive creatures, aren't they? And see, when God was talking to Job, what was he doing? I'm the creator. Look at him. He actually says he ranks first amongst the works of God, something Job could wrap his mind around and be impressed by. So we said that dinosaurs must have existed till pretty recently based on the scientific evidence, unfossilized bones, flesh, DNA, but there's good archaeological evidence too. It's a bit hard to see with the lights on there, but if you can see this creature up in the corner here, he's called a Maiasaura, and it's part of a French tapestry in a castle. And you can see there the earlobes, and this one's actually a duck-billed dinosaur, the right number of toes and everything that we've seen from the fossil record, and that tapestry was made in the 16th century. Angkor Wat in Cambodia, I was able to visit this site a few years ago. There's that great temple that was only rediscovered from the bush in around about the 1600s. When you go there, there are trees and vines still growing through it. And if you can look at the screen, this plate on the right there, at the top you can see there's a human being, and there's a deer. Let's go to the bottom, because that's actually, I don't know if you can make it out, that's actually a marine iguana there. A land iguana, I apologize. And look at this one. Can you see that? There's a close-up of it. Now, if I asked any boys and girls here, any boy and girl, tell me which dinosaur that is. Stegosaurus. See, I do that, mums and dads, because you don't realize our kids know more about dinosaurs than you would imagine. But where do they get that information from? Most of their information from dinosaurs. I would suggest secular books and the millions of years that goes along with it. So again, another area we have to put it in the right context. So there he is. Angkor saw a stegosaur. In fact, they found another one. There are all these temples with all these carvings. But you see, it's got the right number of bony plates on the back, and it's even got the horns there at the front. And notice again, all that stuff comes from Creation magazine. In England a few years ago, one of our scientists went up to Carlisle Cathedral. That's right up in the northern borders of England, where it borders Scotland. And in the back of the church, they had to pull the carpet. And here is the tomb of Bishop Bell. Now, we know the date that he was interred was 1496. And you can see the brass inlays in his tomb. But when we have a close look at them, they're very interesting, because they're creatures we easily recognize, like a bat, a fish, a dog. Notice this is someone's pet, by the way, because it's got a collar on it. A bird, and then we have these interesting creatures. Okay, look at this. These are sauropod dinosaurs, but there's something special about this one on the left, because he's got a little cleft in his tail and a couple of spikes. And there were only two dinosaurs that had that feature, and one of them was this guy called Shunosaurus. So we've got that level of detail there. Down below, and of course there was no natural light in the back, so I apologize for the flash photography, but that looks like the amphibious reptile known as Erops, for example. Here's a ancient Mesopotamian cylinder seal, one of those things they used to roll across to make imprints in the clay. And I'm only using ones here that I kind of think are unmistakable, because this was a very unique sauropod known as Tanistrophius. He had this huge, long, spindly neck, etc. Now, there's a book out there. There's one open, so you can have a look. Big black book. It's a coffee table book called Dire Dragons, Untold Secrets of Planet Earth. There are literally dozens and dozens and dozens of examples just like that in that book. I've just shown you a handful. A Canadian creationist, Vance Nelson, good friend of mine, he's been all over the world looking in museums and monasteries and all sorts of places, showing that humans, up until quite recently, when I say recently, a few hundred years ago, still saw living dinosaurs. So then presents a question, doesn't it? I mean, here's another one, by the way, St. George and the Dragon. So that's that famous English knight that killed a hissing dragon. And you might be thinking, well, hang on, I thought we were talking about dinosaurs. Why are you talking about dragons? Well, remember I said the word dinosaur is a modern word? All over the world, the ancients, when we look at some of these images, they describe them as dragons. So I think, you know, what's become a myth or a legend of dragons are actually probably our real dinosaurs of history. The Chinese called them dragons. In fact, if you have the old King James Version, you'll see the word dragons appears in there. But if people were seeing these in the 1600s, it means there was of course, a global flood, wasn't there, about 2500 BC. Did they, dinosaurs, survive the flood? Of course not. All the creatures were destroyed except those who were on the ark. So were dinosaurs on the ark? Wow, you're an informed bunch, aren't you? There we go. I actually have the photographic evidence here. Here's Noah trying to get Stegosaurus on the ark. One of the big problems is, and I haven't looked in the children's church, but we often see pictures of Noah's ark like this. And I've got to be honest, I'm a bit pickier than most. I mean, I'm a full-time creation writer and researcher, right? But that kind of undermines all the work we're trying to do, because that makes out that Noah's flood was a fairy story. I mean, how's he going to get two of every kind of animal on a leaky bathtub like that? The Bible gives us the dimensions of the ark. 70 feet wide, 60 feet high, three decks, 462 feet long. Have a look at the people down there at the end. By the way, this is not the largest boat that was ever built by humans in antiquity. We just managed to go to Italy, and you'll see stories of even larger wooden vessels than this. And Korean naval architects, there's a technical article on our site, and they've shown that this classic box shape would have been very, very stable in huge seas. It didn't have a bow on it because, well, it didn't have to go anywhere, did it? Because there was nowhere for it to go. The whole world was covered in water. And it would have been a pretty rough voyage, hence the box shape, to give it stability. It had the carrying capacity of 522 railroad cars of stock. And it's been estimated, we've got some technical articles on our website, that Noah really only had to take about 16,000 animals. Now, we didn't have to take insects. They survive on floating logs and all that type of stuff. The marine creatures are okay. So it's just, again, terrestrial animals, birds and land animals. And again, remember I said before, he didn't have to take 300 breeds of dogs. He took a dog kind that's capable of giving us the representatives we have today. So first thing, the ark was plenty big enough. Remember I said the average size of the dinosaurs, probably about the size of a small pony. Some were as small as a chicken. And they all originally were once small. Now, I'm not suggesting that Noah took babies or eggs, because the whole point of taking creatures on the ark was to reproduce after the flood and refill the earth, wasn't it? So they had to be of breeding age. Well, you know what's interesting? When we look at, say, reptiles today, before they're fully grown, they're sexually mature, they can reproduce. In fact, the kind of humans can do that too, can't they? So it's common in the animal kingdom. And here's something from the Secular Nature magazine, and they were looking at the leg bone of a apatosaurus. That's one of those huge, long sauropod dinosaurs. And what they do is they can kind of see growth marks, not like tree rings, but it's the density of the bone. The old dinosaurs have bones that were very, very full. The juvenile dinosaurs, the bones appeared to be porous. And so they plotted this chart, and you can see here, they're saying that around about age 4 to 5, the Apatosaurus underwent a teenage growth spurt, just like humans as well, and then started to level out as they became adults. So, for example, Noah could have taken teenage dinosaurs on the ark, right? Small size, but capable of reproducing after the flood, and then they could have grown into some of these massive creatures. Now, don't get me wrong, probably hundreds of millions of them were destroyed in the flood, like lots of other animals. Which is, again, where we get our fossils from. But you see, we'd always postulated that Noah could have taken teenage dinosaurs on the ark, and again, research comes out that shows that they can have this rapid growth spurt. I mentioned the word species. Look at this guy. He's a liger, because the dad's a lion, mum's a tiger, other way around, it'd be a tigon. Dad gets the naming rights first. But again, remember I said the word species is a man-made word. Lions and tigers are separate species, but they can interbreed. Every member of the cat family is capable of interbreeding, believe it or not. Now, it's not going to happen naturally, is it, in the wild? You're not going to have a lion, you know, mate with a domestic moggy or something like that. It's not going to happen. But genetically, it is actually possible. So we have these modern varieties today that we might call species. Zebras can interbreed with the horses, okay? Sheeps and goats, etc. Camels and llamas can interbreed. They come from a group which we think are now called camelids, etc. So speciation is a kind of specialization where We've got to remember in the post-flood world, we've got new continents, we've got new environments. The continents we have today didn't exist before the flood. And we have hot regions and cold regions and jungle regions. And as animals spread out, okay, you get variation within any created kind, but some are more suited to live in other places. And that's how we get the name species, where they become specialized. That's called natural selection. I don't have time to talk about it tonight, but boys and girls, natural selection is not evolution. Creatures do change over time, but you know, bacteria does not become biologists, all right? We never see that kind of change. We might see change within a created kind. There are limits to that change. So we have these modern varieties. What were those original kinds like? We don't know. Because of the fact we've got specialization all over the world of these creatures. And remember I said to you earlier that they've only often ever found parts of dinosaurs, a few fossils, maybe some vertebrae or something like that. Here's an example where they've been overnaming the fossils they found. This has been not a creationist revolution, but in secular paleontology, they've realized that when they've been finding these fragments of bones, they're really fragments of already known dinosaurs. So I'll give you an example. Here's Dracorex, Stegimoloch, and Pachycephalosaurus. They now know it's exactly the same dinosaur. Dracorex is a juvenile, Pachycephalosaurus is the adult. And the reason they have bony protrusions, right, on their face, on their skull, and they start to grow, just like deer or something like that today. Here's one you'll all know about, okay? Triceratops. Now everyone knows about him because he was the first in that grouping to be found. So he still kind of gets the naming rights, but they've now got 11 others, and you can see the differences in them, but they all know that it came from an original group, which they now call Ceratopsia. 11 different species, but actually one biblical kind. And if I go back there, what I was going to quote, Jack Horner, who's kind of the modern father of dinosaur paleontology, he suggests that 1/3 of all the named dinosaur species may have never existed, but are just merely different stages in the growth of other known dinosaurs. In fact, it gets better than that, because now we think out of around about 200 named species of dinosaurs, we're down to about 50 distinct kinds. Right, so that's possibly about 100 that Noah had to take on the ark. The average size was about the size of a small pony, right? Some were as even small as a chicken, and he's only taking probably juvenile ones that can reproduce after the flood. It's not such a problem when we can think about these things biblically. But what happened to them? That's what you all want to know. Okay, and there's all sorts of ideas, and the most popular one is the giant asteroid theory, where an asteroid hit off the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico and created this kind of global extinction event. The thing with that, though, we find dinosaur fossils on every continent. So if it was that dramatic, it almost should have wiped out all life on Earth. Why did it just select dinosaurs? Now, they would call it a mass extinction event, but it really doesn't fit the evidence. And that giant crater that's off the coast, some people now think it wasn't an explosion, if you like, of being impacted, that it was a subterranean implosion that caused the crater. Again, it happened in the past. We don't know exactly what happened. But quite simply, I think, basically like a lot of other creatures we see today, humans killed them out. I want you to think about the post-flood world. We believe there was an ice age a few hundred years, lasted for a few hundred years after the flood, one and only ice age. Animals migrate around the world, conditions are tough. And a guy like this Triceratops, he wanders into your campsite one night. Well, there's food for a month. Now, do you know if he's the last one on Earth? Of course not. We don't have TV cameras telling you how many's in every forest or whatever. And frankly, you wouldn't care. Not if survival is your main priority of the day. You know, I mentioned Job earlier. When we think of Job and God said to him, you know, look at Behemoth, which I made with you. Right to the end of Job, and you know the story of Job, I'm going to talk about that in the next talk, but he was a troubled guy. He had a lot going on, and he whined and he complained, but God speaks to him in creation passages. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Look at Behemoth. In one sense, God was, you know, reminding him, wasn't he, that he was the creator. He could see his plight and what was happening to him. Do you know, I found that fossils, I did a talk down Macon Way some years ago at a large church, and Wednesday night they'd ferry in all these kids who were not Christian on buses, and they got me down to talk on dinosaurs. And not me, but when I speak on dinosaurs to non-Christian kids, I can tell you they were just transfixed telling them this stuff. And pastor got up and did an altar call at the end. We saw 30-something kids give their life to the Lord. Just talking about dinosaurs. Remember I said this morning, information changes lives. See, I'll tell you how you can use this for the gospel. You know, we've been talking about the flood, etc. And in John 10:9, it reminds us, Jesus says, I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. He will come in, go out, and find pasture. That's analogous to what we read in Genesis 7:16. This is where Noah, or God, is bringing all the animals to the ark, and they enter through that door, right? Animals of every living thing as God had commanded, and then the Lord shut him in. It's very significant, isn't it? Noah didn't kind of close the door behind him. The Lord shut him in. Finality. And in 2 Peter 3:5, warning us about today, look what it says. They will deliberately forget that by long ago, God's word, the heavens existed, the earth was formed out of water and by water, not a hot molten Big Bang notice. By these waters also the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. I said to you this morning, the evidence for Noah's flood is everywhere, ladies and gentlemen. Start digging 20 feet down in your backyard, you'll see it. It's everywhere. But they deliberately forget. No, this is millions of years. I said there's only two games in town, creation or evolution. Well, if evolution's not true, what's left? That's a no-go for some people. And the Lord reminds us, he says, just as it happened in the days of Noah, okay, so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. They were eating, they were drinking, they were marrying, being given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. That's pretty sobering, isn't it? You know, the patriarchs used to live for a long, long time, and creation scientists have estimated that anywhere, listen to this, at the time of the flood, because it's hard to know growth rates when somebody lives for 900 years, right? Population rates. But could have been anywhere from one end, a minimum of about 500,000 people, to at the farthest end, about 2 billion people alive at the time of the flood. Likely to be somewhere in between. Let me ask you, how many people besides Noah and his family survived the flood? That is pretty sobering, isn't it? Can you imagine? Here's Noah building this massive ship on dry land. What are you doing there, Noah? Well, we're building an ark. God's going to destroy the world. Do you think that if people had repented and asked to go down that ark, that God would have let them on? I do. Says he's not willing that any should perish. It shows you how bad the state of the world was in that day, that only 8 people survived, Noah and his family. See, as I said this morning, the Bible is a history book. Okay, the history book of the universe. And it tells us about creation, what went wrong, the events of history. And we can use some of that, particularly in the area of the flood, to explain the world around us today. You see, our culture is becoming more like the culture in Noah's time, isn't it? Scoffing. That's not going to happen. There is no God. He's not going to destroy anything. And here's the other sobering part. The Bible says there's a coming judgment. Not by water. What is it by next time? Fire. A fervent heat. So let me ask you, because I know the hundreds of churches we speak in every year, that there are people that come to church every Sunday, because that's what you do, particularly here in the South. And let me say to the young boys and girls, you're not a Christian here tonight because you go to church. You're not a Christian because you're born into a Christian family. And you big adult Christians are not Christians because you've been coming to church for 30, 40 years perhaps. Let me ask you tonight, are you seriously on the ark of salvation that is Jesus Christ? He's like the ark of Noah's time, isn't it? Isn't he? That those who enter in will be saved. Something we should all seriously consider is our eternal state. So again, we've got a section on dinosaurs, as I said, a couple of resources just before we break. Evolution's Achilles Heels, this is the one Patrick mentioned this morning. The DVD has actually won film awards at Christian film festivals. And these are 15 PhDs who give their reasons. So there's a nuclear physicist talking about radiometric dating, a geneticist talking about genetics and our decaying genome and so on and so forth. This has been extremely, incredibly useful to those people who are kind of steeped in evolution because they're being spoken at their peer level. Again, the books this morning, Geology and the book on dinosaurs. This one is fun. There's some really, really neat images and pictures that kids can be engrossed in with dinosaurs. And I mentioned that book there, Dire Dragons, where humans have pictured, sculptured and carved dinosaurs. And there's a companion book called Monumental Monsters. This one's really fun because in the fossil record pre-flood, we see giantism of creatures that we have today. Had you like to encounter a 3-foot long dragonfly, for example, okay? I'm glad they went extinct, but anyway, there you are. So again, there's another book out there and it's got a different cover on it now. I haven't got a new slide. It's called Busting Myths. It's in a brown cover. And there's over 30 PhD scientists who give their best reasons why they became Bible-believing creationists. The best evidence is in the field. PhD doctors. And there's a book out there by Mike called Deep Time. Again, it deals with this millions of years and where the concept comes from. And he also wrote this book, co-wrote this book called How Noah's Flood Shaped Our Earth. I was watching a documentary last night, as I said, about the Grand Canyon. And when they look at it from the air, when you see it, I mean, it's absolutely massive, right? But when you look at it from a long way up, it reminds me of going to the beach in Australia when we'd get a big wave or a king tide and it would hit the sand dunes and it would carve all these eddies and runways and just shape the sand. That's what it looks like from the air. And that's probably because it's how it was shaped, by a global flood. Very, very hard to kind of model the energy and power of a global flood. This morning I showed you Mount St. Helens. We have some local catastrophes, but nothing like the flood of Noah's time. So we're going to break. I encourage you to go out and get your books, have a look at them now if any of those have piqued your interest. And when the music starts, I'm going to do one song. That's a cue to come back in. All right, thank you. It's going to be more gospel-centered than creation-oriented because as we've discussed this morning, this is kind of the number one question that we get. And by and large, I have to be honest, most of us don't answer it really well. Kind of, well, we don't know with all the answers now, but you just need to be saved, and when do you get to heaven? You know, we'll find out kind of thing. Well, there are answers, and I believe that actually directly addressing this issue correctly, particularly with unbelievers, and let's face it, you've all met Christians who've gone through suffering and difficult times who would say, well, you know, God knows I love him. Why would this happen to my family, etc.? So hopefully this will give you some context as we go through. A few years ago, I wrote on creation.com this article about that earthquake in Haiti. There's just been another earthquake, go figure. Terrible, terrible catastrophe. And when I wrote the article, we allow comments at the bottom of our articles, and this young Christian man wrote in and he said, well, God judged Haiti because they're a voodoo worshipping nation. See, I have a problem with that. Because in fact, one of my co-workers supported a church in Haiti. And the church building was destroyed, the pastor was killed, and 60 people in the congregation. So how does that fit, you see? The fact is, ladies and gentlemen, when we look out in the world today, we see lots of bad things happening, particularly right at the moment. Whether, and I'm not going to get into politics, but whether you think it was escape from a lab or whatever, doesn't matter. A virus that was original, whose original domain was the animal kingdom, through mutation, through entropy, through bad things, has crossed over into human beings and has now killed millions of people. See, we live in a cursed and fallen world. And by the way, before I go on, if you missed it this morning, there it is again, and the QR code. I should have said this morning, I was reminded, point your cameras at that, but there are some sign-up sheets out the back and that QR code there if you want to do it the easy way. So let's discuss this question. Why is their death and suffering in the world? We look at the words of our Lord Jesus. In John 16:33, he says, I've told you these things. In this world, you will have trouble. Anybody here never experienced trouble in their life? Now, it comes in all shapes and forms, doesn't it? When we look out at the world and the terrible things we see, I've kind of distilled it down to two types of trouble. One we might call the natural world disasters, disease, famine, etc., that we see around there. Now, I want you to think about this from the non-Christian's point of view. When we sing things like "all things bright and beautiful," and we use passages like Romans 1:20, it says, "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made." That's a great creationist passage. I mean, I can use that when I'm looking at the intricacy of the cell and genetics. But how do some people see it? How do some people see it when there's earthquakes that kill tens of thousands of people? Or a tsunami, you know, not far off the coast of Australia and near Indonesia that killed 250,000 people? All that was one subduction event. Those tectonic plates built up pressure and one just subducted about 20 feet, that's all. And it sucked the water down and released a wave of energy that rolled across the Indian Ocean and killed 250,000 people. You see? So there is these natural disasters, and then there's what I call man-inflicted stuff. That's where people just do bad things to one another. So we kind of have examples like this. Remember that? Seems a long time ago now. I remember being, and I was actually in Australia when this occurred. I was in Perth, Western Australia, that's where we lived. And it happened prime time in our time zone. And my wife, I was in my study working, and she said, "Gary, come in and watch this." And we were watching the first tower burn, and then the second plane hit. And we were just absolutely stunned watching it in live time. And for the few days after, it was kind of 24/7 coverage on our TV. And as a well-known Australian news presenter, who's known for his antipathy to Christians. And he had a Salvation Army grief counsel. You know, the salvos, they go out in these situations and they try to counsel people. And this interviewer, thinking he was going to trip up the counselor, said, "Well, do you believe that God is creator?" He said, "Yes, absolutely." He said, "Well, do you believe that God is in control of the universe?" He said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, if he's in control, why didn't he stop this?" And he looked at him, Ray Martin, the guy's name. He said, "Ray," he said, "there were men that flew those planes." He said, "Let me ask you, is God in control of your life?" Boy, what an answer on live TV. I can tell you, quickly changed the subject. See, there are two types, as I said, of if you like, natural disasters and man-made, two types, man-made disasters and natural disasters, but they both have the same root cause, and that is sin. Sin explains the mess that our world is in today, ladies and gentlemen. If we go back to Genesis chapter 3, which I referenced several times so far today. "Cursed is the ground because of you. I'm going to put thorns and thistles in it." Why? Why did God curse the ground? Why did he make this change? Why was it going to be hard to work? It was going to be a reminder that something is wrong. None of us should be reconciled with death. And Romans 8:22, that famous passage, the whole creation has been groaning, and some say travailing in sin, etc. A recognition that when we look out, even though we see beautiful aspects of it, like Brother said, that something is wrong out there. And again, that evolutionary worldview, though, remember I said this morning? Well, they'd say, well, that's just part of the selection process. If you're weak, you die. Only the strong will survive. Hang on. Jesus said, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Doesn't sound like survival of the fittest, does it? I want to show you, because I was just talking with Patrick earlier today about some Christian organizations in the US who are happy to add evolution to the Bible. They're called theistic evolutionists. Some of them are very, very famous scientists. Where the inconsistencies would be. Because you can be a Christian, but it doesn't necessarily automatically follow that you'll have a logical Christian worldview. Okay, the two aren't always co-companions. This gentleman here, his name is Bishop Hugh Montefiore. He's a former Anglican Archbishop from the UK, and he wrote the foreword in what's called their confirmation notebook. When you get confirmed at age 13 in the Anglican Church, this is what you read, and I'll read it out. He says, "The Garden of Eden is a myth." He's an archbishop, remember this. okay, or a bishop. He says, from the viewpoint of anthropology, it is exceedingly unlikely there was a first man and woman. Human beings are the result of evolution shaped by natural selection. Self-centeredness and aggression were essential at every stage of evolution. And of course, he calls that original sin. And he said, what the cross is not is the Son standing in my place to take the punishment that I ought to have. Such a view is immoral. In any case, no one person could suffer the whole world's punishment. Can you see how far he has departed from the gospel? And primarily because he added a naturalistic secular concept to explain how the world came about. I said this morning, when our kids try to do that, and that's my experience, when they start to add the millions of years of evolution, it ultimately leads them on the slippery slope of unbelief. Remember I said people will do all sorts of things if they don't think there's a God to be accountable to. We have an epidemic in this country of school shootings. And the most famous one was at Columbine, right? And these guys, they call themselves the Trench Coat Mafia. They posted on their website, sometime in April, me and V will get revenge and kick natural selection up a few notches. They just thought humans are really nothing more than just evolved animals. This is another one, a Finnish shooting. He posted this video on YouTube. Notice some of the things he says. Life is just a coincidence, the result of a long process of evolution. Evolution is both theory and a fact. Creationism is neither one. Humans are just a species amongst other animals. Death is not a tragedy. It happens all the time. I, as natural selector, will eliminate all who I see unfit. That sounds pretty radical, doesn't it? But actually, there's been some very famous people in history who had those ideas. Hitler. Getting rid of the unfit, the weak, the mentally handicapped. If you watch our documentary, Evolution's Achilles Heels, we show a German propaganda movie which showed handicapped people. And we've got the English subtitles, but the German narrator says, we cannot allow these drooling imbeciles to exist and basically pollute the gene pool. Is that how the Lord Jesus would want us to treat our fellow human beings made in his image? Mutations and things occur, which is why we see birth defects today. But they were following the mantra of this guy. And he wrote there in The Origin of Species, he says, thus from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the higher production of higher animals, he's talking about man, directly follows. That's that, as I said this morning, that tree of life, a tree of death, human beings are at the top. So it really helps to understand when you're talking to someone who's not a Christian, this is the concept that they believe in of how the world came to be. And mistakenly, because they've never heard creation, they think, oh, so you're telling me God used this process of death and suffering over millions of years to create. Well, let's be honest, would you actually want to worship a God like that? I wouldn't. Culling out millions and millions of species because they're unfit in some selection process, etc. My former mentor, boss in Australia who brought me into the ministry, Dr. Carl Wieland, is retired now. He said this, he said, if Darwin was right, there is no ultimate meaning or purpose to life except what we choose. You're born, you suffer, you die, that's it. Perhaps if you're lucky, you get recycled as organic manure, but beyond that, you're just a number that happened to come up in the great casino of the universe. No meaning or purpose to life. Remember I showed you this morning, this geologic column. This is the foundation of millions of years of death and suffering on the earth. This is where it comes from. If you recall this morning, I said you can't have death and suffering before the fall. It has to come about as a result of the fall. I said in the dinosaur talk, we all were originally vegetarian. There's Genesis 1:29. I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, every tree that has fruit with seed in it, they will be yours for food, and to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the heavens, to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I've given you every green plant for food. Okay, so when you had your bacon sandwich this morning, were you sinning? No, because after the flood, what does God say? Oops, let me go forward a couple, I missed it. Genesis 9:3, everything that lives and moves will be food for you, just as I gave you the green plants, now that I gave you everything. So, can't be dogmatic about this, but obviously pre-fall, pre-flood, pre-flood, all that we needed came from plants. That's what God gave us. Remember I said the only thing that survived the flood were those terrestrial animals on the ark. It's possible that a lot of the protein-bearing plants that we needed could have been wiped out in the flood. We know that a lot of marine creatures went probably extinct as a result of the flood. In fact, when you look at that geologic column that I showed you there before, I'm going to make a point here, that when you look at it, you kind of get the impression this is an equal distribution of all these fossils in these rock layers. In fact, over 98% of all the fossils found are these creatures down here that typically live on the ocean floor. Right? But it gives you the impression that somehow there's an equal number or an equal distribution. In fact, when you see that, and I say that these are laid down by Noah's flood, what we're looking at here is probably an order of burial. Because I said the flood started in the fountains of the Great Deep broke ocean. When we look at tsunamis today, we see those waves moving along the deep water and it's just a swell. But when it reaches the land and as it shallows out, then they become those destructive waves. But they're moving at hurricane speed. And we know about these things called turbidity currents. That is where the waves are moving along, energy waves, and they're churning up lots of silt and mud on the ocean floor. So creatures that typically live just on the ocean floor are going to get buried. That's what you would expect when there was a global flood, when the supercontinent broke up and you've got tsunamis and massive waves of energy running all over the earth. And that's what we see. Over 98% of the fossils are creatures that typically live on the ocean floor. And think about it, when the water hits the land, okay, it's not going to be so easy to bury a land creature. As I said, most of them will probably float and bloat and rot and get eaten by other creatures later on. The first death did not occur in the Bible, okay, until Genesis chapter 2. Remember when God saw them sin, he made a clothing of skin for them when they became self-aware and naked. Did I say two? Chapter three, the four. So this is actually the first death recorded in the Bible. They suddenly became self-aware. They'd broken that communication line to God. What have we done, basically? So after the flood, yes, God now gives us meat. We've got to get our protein from somewhere. Okay, and have a look back here. This is the gospel. God created the heavens and the earth. Genesis chapter 3, enmity between you and the woman. I've got the KJV version there for some reason. Greatly increase our pain in childbearing. Cursed is the ground, as I mentioned before. You're going to toil. It's going to produce thorns and thistles, etc. So we have so many joys and benefits in this world. And I think sometimes we can bypass the fact that all of this death that we see reminds us, again, I repeat, that something is wrong. And it was our actions that brought death into the world. So what does this have to do with this question of why God allows it to continue? In fact, believe it or not, Jesus was asked this question. We go here to John. Oh, sorry, wrong passage again. Luke 13, I'm looking at tiny notes. Luke 13. And it tells the story here. It says, there were some present at the time who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. So he's being told, what about these people over here? Notice how he questions. He knows what they were thinking. He says, do you think these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered this way? Now, he didn't answer the question of why their face was picked out of the crowd. But look what he says. I tell you no, but unless you repent, you too will perish. And then there's this account of the Tower of Siloam. 18 people died when this tower fell on them. And he says, do you think they were more guilty than all the others living in Jerusalem because they died that way? He says, I tell you no, but unless you repent, you too will perish. See, does it matter why, in one sense? Because all of us, sadly, are going to die someday. It might come quicker than we'd like. It might come in an unknown way. But that's why it's important to be saved today, isn't it? Exactly why we need to be saved today. And I suppose a lot of people, and particularly Christians, have done this and said, well, why me? You know, this was asked of God once. Why did the sinners prosper? Jeremiah asked that. Remember poor old Jeremiah? He was preaching and they wanted to stone him. And he complains to the Lord. He says, you're righteous, Lord. When I'd bring a case before you, I love this, yet I'd speak with you about your justice. We think God's not patient, right? Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why do all the faithless live at ease? Why did my family member get cancer? And him over there, he doesn't care about you one little bit. Well, are there any good people? Are there any righteous people on the earth today? No, according to Scripture, it says, the Lord looks down from heaven, there is none who does good, not even one. Because as I said this morning, we're born sinners. See that famous passage there in John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son. Whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. We love that passage, and I often wonder, why don't we mention verse 17? For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world might be saved through him. Isn't that incredible? You see, I didn't know God. You know, I was one of those rabid atheists who used to use this very, very question to tackle my non-Christian friends. And they never gave me a decent answer. Never ever explained it at all to me. But God is capable of saving us because he's the creator. Let me put it another way. Only the creator has the power to save us. Not just some good man hanging on a cross like I thought. That's a noble idea. But it's not grounded in any supernatural reality that God can save me from a godless eternity. You know, that is our Christian worldview. I showed it this morning. A good creation marred by sin, the corruption. There was a catastrophe, right? Noah's flood, where God judged the world once and he's going to do it again. The confusion, the Tower of Babel, where people move off separated by languages, again, into different environments, and that's how come with people with more melanin and more skin, melanin content in their skin will survive better in hot climates than people with fair skin. In Australia, we have the highest rates of skin cancer in the world. You're not even allowed to send your child to school without a sun. So when Captain Cook discovered the place in 1788, he found mainly dark-skinned Aboriginals living there. Why? Because dark skin is a survival advantage in hot climates. It's a natural sunscreen. So people with fair skin, we get sun cancers, we die. We don't pass that information on to the next generation. Again, natural selection. But it can only select from what is already available in the gene pool. And of course, the very reason Christ came and died that horrible, cruel death on a cross, ladies and gentlemen, is because of what happened back here. If we abandon Genesis in our witnessing to answer this question, it's just not going to make any sense to anybody. And as I said this morning, there's going to be a new heavens and a new earth, a restoration. What is he restoring things back to? Restoration means restoring it back to some originally good condition. Again, which is what we spoke about today. When we take God's word as authority, we can understand the better context of these things. Romans 8:22, there's that passage. Whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together unto now. We ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption, the redemption of our body. We were saved in this hope. When we, in the resurrection, in the new heavens and earth, you and I are going to have new bodies. It's a physical creation, ladies and gentlemen. That's something I've been staggered by. People think we're going to be some ethereal, ghostly spirits. It's a new heavens and earth, a real physical restoration. Because all the old stuff has to be obliterated. It's drastic. But as long as there would remain a fossil in the ground, Satan would win. Because that's a reminder of death and what went wrong. That's why it's so drastic that God has to create a new heavens and earth. But I love this, hope that is seen is not hope. We eagerly wait for it in perseverance. And the last enemy to be destroyed is death. That's the worst thing. That was the cosmic catastrophe. Do you know, when Adam and Eve were created, they would have lived eternally, and you and I as their descendants. So why did God bring a curse? Well, think about it. Their sin had separated them from God. So they would have been eternally separated from God. Wow. But actually, because God brought a curse, if you now believe in the one whom God sent, you can be reconciled back to your Creator. That's why God introduced death into the world. It's the mechanism by which we can be restored and resurrected and redeemed. I mentioned those passages this morning. Let me talk about Job again. I remember as a young Christian, the book of Job had a huge impact on me. And I tell you what, theologians have written all sorts of books on this, and I think they overcomplicate things. It's pretty simple. Here's Satan, stands before God, the accuser. Look at Job down there. God says, yeah, he's a righteous man. Ever seen anyone like him? And kind of Satan's really, in a way, says he only loves you because of what you've given him, because of what he's got. Poor old Job, he sees none of this, does he? He doesn't see what's going on in the heavenlies. And kind of Satan does his worst. He gets sick, he loses family members. He's got those well-meaning friends that come up, you know, Christians that say, wow, stuff's really going bad in your life. What sin have you been committing? No, he just lived in a cursed and fallen world like the rest of us. And even when his wife says, you know, curse God and die. And he's human, he whines and complains. But you know what? He utters this. Though he slay me, yet will I hope in him. Regardless of his circumstances, remember I said earlier, God was talking to him in creation passages. He was reminding him, I'm the one that made everything around you, including that big behemoth over there. I'm capable of raising your dusty bones back from the ground. And one of the most amazing passages in Scripture. I want you to put this into context, what I'm trying to do. What Job was going through. He'd lost everything that he had, basically. And he would not curse God. And he says here, I know that my Redeemer lives. And at the last, he will stand upon the earth. Look at this. After my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh, his own physical being, I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold and not another. My heart faints within me. He hadn't seen Jesus come. There'd been no advent. But he had faith that God was capable of doing that. And it was primarily based upon the fact he was the Creator. Because that's the terms that Job spoke to him in. And I started off by talking about this passage in John 16:33, where Jesus says, I've told you these things, right, that you will have trouble. I left out that middle bit, that in me you may have peace. That you may have peace. We have, right at this moment, ladies and gentlemen, we are living, for most of us, in a time we've never experienced before, and an uncertain fate or future possibly before us because of a terrible virus that's going around. Jesus adds here, take heart, I have overcome the world. Which other religious leader rose from the dead? See, that's such a pivotal point. You see the context? Death, curse, Jesus raising the dead. Revelation, no more curse. Jesus rises from the dead. He can only do it once again because he's the Creator. And because we face this uncertain future, that's why 2 Corinthians 6:2 says, behold, now is the day of salvation. Not tomorrow. We need to be saved today. I'm not making light of this because it was an awful situation, but do you think those people that went to work on 9/11 and were sitting in the 72nd floor of their office expected a plane to come through the window? No. You see, that's the type of stuff we can say to those who are outside. If something like that happens to you, how do you know what's going to happen to you tomorrow? Where do you know you're going to be? What do you think is going to happen to you when you die? Remember this morning the three big questions? What they think about what happens to them when they'll die will depend upon whether they believe they're created or evolved. And we get back to that basic foundational argument again. Because the reality is, even the most rabid evolutionists in this world, they're not reconciled with death. No one's looking forward to death. And we can explain exactly what the problem is, because Christianity has the right answer, if you like, to the problem of evil in this world and to the wrong things that we see. Do you know, pastor will know, when you're a prominent Christian in your family or whatever, people look to you. And sometimes it's not easy. You know, a few years ago, I lost my beautiful big sister to cancer. Horrible. Just watching her just fade away. And then 12 months later, I lost my dad. And, you know, all my family grieving, they're looking for me. But I can tell you, I was struggling. Struggling with it all. But, you know, my big sister, I was the first Christian in my family. I was the first one to get saved out of a rabid, atheistic, evolutionary worldview. And then I saw my dad saved, and I saw my sister saved, and I saw my mum saved, and then I saw my wife saved after me. It took a while. And as my sister sat there, and I knew she was going to die, I said, I was crying my eyes out. And she turned around to me and she says, "Don't worry, we're going to see each other again." She believed that God was capable of raising her dusty bones back from the ground. See, they're the types of conversations you can have with people. Real conversations. One of the things we're really good at as Christians, and I've had to learn the lesson because, you know, I think I have a lot of answers, is we don't get people up against the wall and beat them to death with answers. You know, let me just touch on something. Whether you agree or not, okay, I don't think it matters whether you think wherever COVID came from. But the fact is our hospitals are bursting and people are dying around us and they don't know Christ. And, you know, I've been discouraged, I'll be honest, that people want to talk about political aspects. Well, it's not as bad as it is and, you know, it was released by the China. They are distractions for us, ladies and gentlemen. You go down that path, you have lost the plot. I'm sorry. You might not like me now and want to refund the books, that's fine. But what we should be doing is extending empathy to people around us who are suffering loss and helping them understand. What an opportunity we have right now. You know, when this first came out, when was it? Back in January or February 2020, I did a podcast with Dr. Robert Carter and the virus was still in China, in Wuhan, and I said, boy, can you imagine if it ever came to the US and we'd be shutting down cities like Atlanta and New York? We couldn't even imagine it. And when it did, within 10 days, we wrote a tract about the coronavirus, put it free on our website so people could print out thousands and thousands of copies at leisure to go out there and explain, where did these viruses come from? How come they're in the world today? If God's a creator, where did these bad viruses come? I answered all those questions solely with the aim, as Pastor said, what is that fourth goal you're after here? It's evangelism, isn't it? Reaching others. And that ultimately, ladies and gentlemen, is what all this information has been about today. It's great for me to sit up here and talk about the scientific facts of creation. It doesn't mean anything unless we can use it. And again, that's why we have all those resources out there. Because let me ask you this, okay? What are you taking to heaven with you? Huh? The nice car, the PlayStation, the house? The only thing we're taking to heaven with us are the people we lead to Christ. It's the only thing that's coming with us. And I look back at my family members and I just thank God for his mercy, that he saved a sinner like me and that my family could see the change. Again, last opportunity, we give those free gifts with the magazine, the DVDs. You can't get that on the website, okay? So that's only available when we go to ministry as an encouragement to get to you. I mentioned melanin colour. Let me talk about this one. Because I spoke of, kind of using the term natural selection. And I mentioned this morning that the modern genomics revolution has shown that human beings were more than 99% similar. So where does this idea or this man-made term of races come from? This is probably the most popular article we ever featured in Creation magazine, the two-tone twins. Okay? So the answer here is that the parents are actually in the medium brown skin range. It's a pigment called melanin. We all have it, by the way. I was going to look for some white paper, but I mean, if I held my hand up here today, you can see my hand is not white. It's light brown, like most of us here. Some of you are dark brown, mid-brown. There's always this range. But when you're in the medium range, medium brown hair, medium brown eyes, you have the most genetic potential to produce variation in your offspring. Let me give you an example I shared with a guy this morning. Imagine you've got a group of dogs and you've got short fur, medium fur, long fur. And you take that whole group of dogs and you go and dump them in Alaska. Which ones have a survival advantage? Dogs with long fur. So they reproduce and the short fur dogs and the medium fur dogs get culled. They get wiped out. So they get specialized, all right, to their environment. Evolutionists say, well, look, evolution's true, but what you've done, you've just reduced the genetic information that was available originally because you've lost the genes for short and medium fur. Can you see that? Evolution, to get from pond scum to professors, you've got to add encyclopedias worth of information. And it's the same here in the medium brown range, right? You could produce, if they've got white in your background, potentially dark and light offspring in one generation. So I'm telling you this because we believe, there's the girls growing up now, Adam and Eve must have had medium brown skin, medium brown hair, medium brown eyes. They had lots of sons and daughters. Some of them would have gone from light to dark. And I said earlier in this talk, dark skin is a natural sunscreen. So as people move around the world, if they have that selection advantage, it's typically why you see dark skinned people living in very, very hot climates. Now, my wife, if you go out there, she's a beautiful blonde Aussie Sheila, as we'd say. She's got blonde hair, blue eyes, fair skin. If you have blue eyes, by the way, you don't have very, very much. They're not coloured blue. There's a very, very little amount of melanin. It's the way the light refracts through and they look blue. And we've got four children. And I don't think I got a look in the gene wars because they all came out with blonde hair, blue eyes, fair skin, just like their mum. And so if they go and marry somebody else who's got blonde hair, blue eyes, fair skin, all you produce is blonde-haired, blue-eyed, fair-skinned people, right? Which I always point out to my wife shows that blondes do have less information. genetic information, sorry, I mean, so there we go. So again, there's the answer, and again, genetics is caught up. Remember I said this morning, the Bible has said, of one man, he made all nations of men. So the magazine, $29, you get the free digital, whether you get 1 year or 2 years, but you get the free DVDs with the two. There's sign-up sheets out the back. This is the most popular resource. We get more feedback from a magazine than anything else we produce because it's disarming, isn't it? You give somebody a colour magazine and they get hit between the eyes with all this information. So I encourage you to get that. A reminder of some of those packs out there. That book, again, we've only touched the surface. An incredible resource for study, but you would just enjoy it. This is one for high school teens. I particularly think this is the nicest book we've ever produced. It's called A Question of Origins, and on our website, there's a CD's worth of exercises and studies that you can do. Beautifully illustrated. This is kind of for middle school and up. Very, very difficult to get good curriculum today for teens, but that teaches about worldviews. It teaches about evolution. It's really important to understand what evolutionists think so you can put the biblical creation in the right context. And I've got a DVD out there called Why Does a Good God Allow Bad Things? It's an expanded version of this talk today. And it might be just nice to give to somebody who's struggling with this issue. You know, I've had more feedback from that talk out of any of all the talks that I've ever done over that particular one. Who made God? We sang in one of the worship songs this morning, God was there before time began, and I alluded to it. But it's a real question that the atheists say, well, if God's the creator, who created him? It's a total misunderstanding of the nature of God, but it's a really important topic that teens bring up. And what's the new heavens and earth going to be like? I touched on it today. I said it's going to be a real physical creation. If it's not, it's meaningless to talk about it in terms of our restoration. My colleague Lita helps me with that one as well. This question was asked today. There's a booklet there I co-wrote, Gay Marriage Writer On, big topical one. And I can tell you it's in very, very loving terms. Because not only when our kids go off to college are they going to be confronted with evolution, but they're going to meet really, really nice people, right, who are homosexual. How many times do you have that conversation? Well, I don't know if God's really going to judge them. I mean, they're really nice. They just love each other. That's what you hear. Our young ones tend to think with this sometimes, right? So again, just a logical way of setting it out. It's in a right tone, just a $3.50 booklet. And again, this is a huge topic out there. I don't know if you've been following, but the government has been drip feeding us for the first, I've been studying this for years and this has never happened, been drip feeding us with UFO sightings from the military. I just about fell off my chair because they've always had plausible deniability. And I suspected something was coming. And just before Trump left office as part of his COVID relief package, they had to produce a report to the Senate Intelligence Committee of UFO reports between that the military had seen between 2004 and 2019, 140 something cases. And the report has come out, we've got articles on our website, but that is a great conversation starter. I said to Patrick earlier on today, when we were doing the filming for the movie, people were coming up and saying, oh, what's going on, what's going on? And I tell you, I've done it long enough, I say, we're making a movie about aliens. Really? I tell you what, it's a conversation starter. If people don't want to talk about Christianity, try them on that subject. And again, we've got the resources for you to give out. Let me leave you with that one again. Hopefully this has been useful to you. And again, as I said this morning, you feel a little bit more equipped to deal with it. Let me encourage you to evangelism. We're so often intimidated. We're intimidated because we think we're going to get questions we can't answer. But let me say this as a word of encouragement to you. It's not my job or your job to save people. You can't save anybody, can you? But we are called to be faithful witnesses. And that's all we're called to do. That's why I can bravely get on a plane and talk to people, and I know others are eavesdropping, because I've just learnt that burden that we sometimes feel, you know, I can pass that on to the Lord. As long as I'm faithful in my witnessing, He's the one that saves people. God bless you.
For more information, visit us online at tabernaclebaptist.org. Thanks for listening.